I think we'll begin this session. My name is Christine Carlson, and the title of this session is Four Mothers of the ALCW. I'd like to tell you briefly a little bit about myself. I just graduated from Luther Northwestern Seminaries in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I'm awaiting a call in the American Lutheran Church. I've been assigned to the Southeastern Minnesota District, so I'm hoping for a call in the Twin Cities because my husband is just starting his second year at the seminary. And we also have a new baby named Kai, and so to handle all these aspects of our lives, it will be helpful if I can have a call in the Twin Cities area. So I'm hoping that comes through. I'm also employed part-time by the American Lutheran Church, the Division for Service and Mission in America, to do work on women's issues. And so as part of my work for that division, and also through a church history class this spring, I got very interested in the history of the ALCW. And for my church history class, I contracted with the professor to do a project, and I said that I was interested in working on the history of the ALCW. And he said that was just fine. So I went down into the archives at the seminary and started my work, and emerged about 4 months later, having gotten up to 1917. There is so much material, and it's such rich material. So when I said in my topic today that it was four mothers of the ALCW, I really meant four mothers. Well, the organizations and people that we'll be looking at are from about 1850 to 1917, so this is ancient history. But I haven't gotten beyond 1917 in my work at all. So that's where our study will stop today. And I think much of what we'll talk about today is very relevant and important for what's happening today with the merger of the LCA and ALC, because the year 1917 is the year of a very significant merger in the history of the American Lutheran Church. So some of the issues might surface that we're struggling with today. I have three goals for this session. First of all, I'd like to share three stories with you this morning. These stories will by no means give a complete picture of the ALCW, but I hope that they'll present a sketch, and I find it a very fascinating sketch, of some of the organizations and women who laid the foundations, who did the pioneer work for the American Lutheran Church Women's Organization that we have today. The stories that I'm going to relate are specific to the American Lutheran Church, but they're similar in many other ways, in many ways, to other women's organization stories and other church bodies. One of the main differences, I think, is that other women in other church bodies got a head start on our Lutheran mothers. You can think of Methodist or Presbyterian women, for instance. They were organizing mission societies and ladies' aid groups in the early 1800s, starting around 1830 and 40. Out in the East Coast. I think the main reason for that is that they had been here longer. Their mothers or grandmothers had been the ones who had come to this country. The Lutheran women organizing these groups in the 1850s were the immigrant pioneer women themselves, and they just had to work hard to get food on the table and clothes on their back, and to get an organization going was a lot of work. So that's the main difference, I think. So if you're Methodist or Presbyterian, much of what I say today will apply to women's organizations in your churches too, with many differences, but there are some common threads. The second thing I'd like to do after sharing these stories is to pull out of them issues that I think are significant about why these organizations got started, what their goals were, things like that. I'd like to explore some of the issues that I think are important and interesting. And then the third goal is to leave some time at the end, and it won't be much, but some time to hear from you and to give you time to look at some of the pictures that I've hung up here. There's Xeroxed pictures of photographs from the materials that I've been working with in the archives, and it will give you just a feel, I hope, for the wealth of material and the exciting kind of material that there is available for us as we look through our history as women in the church. To begin, I'd like to talk briefly about the family tree of the American Lutheran Church. And this is probably old stuff to some of you, it was new and interesting to me when I started to do this research. And I've done the family tree in two ways. On the top line is the synod, the general synod name. On the underneath the line is the name of the women's organization that was a part of that synod. So we can start over here with where we are presently in the ALC, which was formed in 1960. The Lutheran Free Church came into our body and into the body in 1963, and our women's group is called the ALCW. The ALC was the result of a merger in 1960 of the ALC, the ELC, and the UELC. All these initials. There are some women here from the ALC who talked with me before the session. Unfortunately, I haven't had a chance to get down to Wartburg Seminary archives yet, where the ALC material is located. I was limited because of my pregnancy and several other factors to doing work in the Twin Cities. And so the work that I'll share with you today centers on the ELC and it's the organizations that led into that. And then this is the Danish branch, the UELC, and I haven't had a chance to research that either. So you'll see that the body of work that I want to present to you today and talk with you about is from the ELC. The women's organization in the ELC was called the Women's Missionary Federation. And the ELC was the result of a merger in 1917 of three bodies, the Hauge Synod, the Norwegian Synod, and the United Norwegian Lutheran Church. The women's organizations were the Mission Dove of the Hauge Synod. I don't speak Norwegian. A snakke norsk. Prestakona Forening of the Norwegian Synod. They never adopted an English title for their women's group, which is interesting to me. And then the Ladies' Aid and the Women's Missionary Federation. The United Norwegian Lutheran Church had two women's organizations in it. So this is what I'll be discussing with you today. And I apologize if you were ALC and were from that root and we're coming hoping to hear about your group today. I'm sorry that I haven't.
I think the old Ohio Synod, you would have to go to Columbus.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. I need to go to both Wartburg and Columbus, and there are also more materials at Luther College archives too. So there are a couple places and in Blair, Nebraska for the Danish stuff for the UELC. So you can see I'm just beginning on this work. So what I'd like to do today is to share briefly the stories of the Norwegian Synod women, the United Norwegian Lutheran Church women, and the Hauge Synod women. And I'll try to share some of the interesting facts, some of the interesting people, and some of the reasons why they finally got organized. Because in the beginning, the women in these three church branches weren't organized. They didn't come to this country with the idea of organizing women in their minds. They were, for the most part, poor women when they got here, pioneer women, and as I said, it was just survival that was important to them. Another factor that is important for you to know about the history is that there are sketchy records. Women were so busy doing things that they didn't have time to write down what they were doing. So there's some lot of gaps in what I'm saying today. My information for women's work in the Norwegian Synod comes from a report that was prepared in 1932 for the 15th anniversary of the merged church. So that's where my information is coming for the most part. Women in the Norwegian Synod were finally the least formally organized women of any of these three church bodies. They formed this group, the Prestakona Forening, but it was never a formal organization. They never adopted a constitution with bylaws. So they remained the most informal of these groups. Their first effort was to raise money to build a school of the Norwegian Synod. And this was called the Universitetsfonde. My Norwegian is very bad, but the university fund or the college fund. And it says in the records that a woman named Mrs. Kari Skjervegen, gave $5. That was the first contribution. And finally, the school that they were building, of course, was Luther College. And when that school was finished in 1865, women's contributions amounted to $1,500, which is just an enormous amount of money when I think back on this is the Civil War period, which is a rough time in the country. These women were poor pioneer women. And to help shape Luther College, they raised $1,500, which they contributed. And then it says in the records that besides this financial contribution, they contributed as well funds to needy students, and not only money, but clothing, food, and furnishings. Very generous women in the Decorah, Iowa, and larger Iowa areas who were helping then. The woman who prepared this report in 1932 said this about these efforts: "It was no trifling gift when women individually contributed, as they sometimes did, up to $50. And when you think about how those women were saving a nickel here, a nickel there, and to come up with contributions like that, it's enormous the sacrifice that they must have endured to support this school and these students. These were women in the 1850s, 60s who were working in Iowa. In the next generation, there is little women's work in a broader organized way. There was the idea in the church that women's work should be local, in the congregation only, not organized in a broad way. And there was also a lot of reshuffling of the Norwegian Synod during this time. I don't know all the ins and outs of that, but that made it difficult to get women organized, the record said. But during this time, there's one foremother of the Norwegian Synod that I'd like to talk a bit about. Her name is Didrika Brandt, and she's often called the mother of Luther College. I wish I could have met her. I was interested to talk with one woman here who knew her son, and I'd love to get a picture of this woman. I can't find a picture of her in the archives, and she must have been something. She came over in the late 1850s, crossed the Mississippi, and settled in Decorah, Iowa. Had many children and not much money. In order to raise money, she did laundry for 50 cents. And another project that she took on was making communion wafers. She made 1,000 for a dollar. That was her price. Can you imagine all the work that went into those communion wafers? But she was able, with these kinds of jobs, to raise money not only to clothe and feed her family, but to give away over the period of her life $600 to help needy students at Luther College. So she, for me, has become a model of the kind of woman that must have been working in these days to contribute and support efforts in her community. Didrika Brandt also organized the women of her local congregation into a sort of a quilting circle or a sewing circle that took on as its task to mend the clothes of the students at Luther College. This is a time when Luther College was an all-male school. It was not co-ed for a period of time as it is now. And so I guess in order to help these men who didn't know how to thread a needle, these women of Decorah, Iowa organized themselves to mend the male students' clothes. And that custom continued until the First World War. So that was a great work, I guess, for those women. But at this time also, you can see in the historical records the beginning of women's support for mission. And that's one of the common themes that we'll see. Women of the church organizing for mission. Women started to raise money at this time to support missions in Zululand and in China, and then also mission work at home to support Siemens immigrant and Negro missions, to support children's home, what they called sunset homes. At that time, that's such a quaint phrase, I think, but sunset homes, to support Lutheran hospitals, theological seminaries, and church schools. The long list of places where women sent their money to support mission work both home and abroad. And finally, in 1903, the women of the Norwegian Synod decided that they would organize themselves, not formally with a constitution, but formally enough to adopt a name and to do some work in a broad organizational way. The name they chose, as I've said, is Prestakona Forening. Is there someone here who speaks Norwegian?
Ening. If you say the E long,
and what does that mean?
Means an organization.
Okay, so yes. Pastor's Wives Organization, is that?
Uh-huh. Pastor's Wives Organization.
Okay, thank you. And this group was limited to pastors' wives. They also allowed professors' wives in it. But other women of the church were not in this group. And the reason that they organized, it's said in this report, was that they recognized the power of group strength, that what they could do locally was limited perhaps to just local projects, but if they joined together to raise money and to combine their efforts, they could do more work at a larger scale. So for that reason, they organized. And I guess that they, this Prestakona for Eaning, this pastor's wife's organization, stimulated greatly giving by women, not only from this pastor's wives group, but also by women in the church at large. They took it on as one of their tasks to inspire women to give more money. And with these increased funds that this women's organization had then, they funded three special projects that you might be interested in hearing about. They set up the first scholarship fund for students at Luther College. It's called the Aid Fund for Needy Students. And it had a Norwegian title, which I won't try to pronounce. If you're interested, I'll show you it afterwards. But they established the Fund for Needy Students at Luther College. A second thing that they did was to collect money, and they collected in the end $2,547, another enormous amount of money, I think, to buy a bronze statue of Martin Luther for Luther College, which still stands at the school. And the third thing that they did was to buy to raise money to buy a marble statue of Christ made out of Carrara marble, which stood at Hamlin. What's now Hamlin College is the old Luther Seminary of the Norwegian Synod. And this marble statue of Christ was another thing that they raised money for. So it's interesting to me to look at the way these women were spending their money. They raised a lot of funds for foreign and home missions. They were concerned about the needs of poor students, both in financial ways and in helping them with mending their clothing, furnishing their rooms. And they were also interested in education. They were also interested in aesthetics and in the importance of their children learning their cultural roots, the statue of Martin Luther, and in appreciating art with these two statues. Those are some of the areas where they chose to spend their monies and their efforts. So that's the story of the women of the Norwegian Synod. I'd like to move on now to the United Norwegian Lutheran Church, this on the bottom line there of this merger, and to talk particularly about their second organization, the Women's Missionary Federation. My information and stories for this are from a variety of loose papers that were in a folder in the archives, and then from a formal report that was given by Mrs. Theodore Engen at the 1932 15th anniversary of the merger. These women of the United Norwegian Lutheran Church were more organized in a formal way than the women of the Norwegian Synod. They already had a ladies' aid group that existed in local congregations, and the work of the ladies' aid focused on doing work of the church and on helping the needy institution, the institutions immediately surrounding the church, helping the needy in that area. In 1890, the United Church started mission work in southwest Madagascar. They had finally gotten funds and efforts organized enough to begin mission work in southwest Madagascar, and a call went out to the church at large that there was a need for $10,000 to help fund this mission work in Madagascar. At that point, there were a very few women's missionary societies that began in the United Church. But they were localized in congregations and not connected with one another. In 1898, a woman named Mrs. T.H. Dahl, who's a very fascinating woman, we'll hear about her now in this story, first shared her dream of an organized, broad effort of church women to help with mission work. And I'd like to read briefly from Mrs. Engen's report, where she tells about how Mrs. Dahl came up with this dream, because it was kind of a unique thing. She writes, "In the summer of 1898, Mrs. T. H. Dahl first mentioned the necessity of an organization of our church women. I remember it well. Mr. and Mrs. J. N. Kildall," that's another big name in the United Church. There's a dorm named Kildall Hall at St. Olaf College. That's this Kildall family. "My husband, Mr. Engen, and I were visiting 2 days at the Dahl summer camp on Lake Caganza near Stoughton, Wisconsin. During the afternoon, while enjoying the cool shade and lake breeze, Mrs. Dahl turned to this group, the Kildalls, the Engens, and Mr. Dahl, and said, 'Friends, something has been brewing in my mind for a long time. I have dreamed about it and prayed over it. I must speak of it now. Mr. Dahl," they called each other Mr. and Mrs. Dahl, "is the only one I have mentioned it to. He thinks it would be a work of value. I feel our women should begin to plan for a mission federation. Other church denominations have federations and are succeeding. What women in other churches are doing, our women, by the grace of God, could do if only we could get a start. The greatest question is this: what will our pastors think about it? And how will our women take to it?'" She goes on to say, "After discussing a while, Reverend Kildall said, 'Yes, Mrs. Dahl, it is a fine thought. You go ahead. Bring the proposition to the pastors and the women of the church. They may not take kindly to it at first. There will be many obstacles to overcome, and a great many may object to women taking work like this into their own hands.' 'Yes,' replied Mrs. Dahl, 'I know it will be uphill work and take a long time. We may not get far in our day. It may take a whole generation before we have a real strong organization. We may rest below the sod before it will be fully realized.'" And then Mrs. Engen goes on to say, "This vision was prophetic. What a satisfaction to her before she passed away to see, to some extent, the realization of her dreams and plans." But what a visionary woman this Mrs. Dahl must have been, to have this idea and then to go to work to implement it. The impetus for this seemed to be first the need for mission work, for mission funds, and also inspired by the fact that women in other church bodies had formed such organizations. Maybe we women of the United Church could do it too. The problem, the real obstacle standing in their way, were the pastors and the women of the church who were against women working outside their local congregations. So we'll see that theme recur as the Haugi women try to get together. In 1902, they again talked about this at the Dahl summer camp. And they were talking this time with a woman named the Mrs. Reverend Hoyme, as they call her. Her husband was a pastor, Reverend Hoyme, and so they called her Mrs. Reverend Hoyme. And there's a Hoyme dorm at St. Olaf College also. These are some of the old families that were important in the founding of St. Olaf College. And they were talking with Mrs. Reverend Hoyme. Her husband was the first president of the United Church, so she was a powerful woman of this church synod. She was very supportive of the idea of forming a women's missionary federation. But after expressing her support, she said this: "It will take time and tact. Our pastors are very conservative, and many of them firmly believe it wrong and unbecoming for the women to step out into public work. We must be very careful and go slowly. Pray, hope, and believe God will bless such a worthy undertaking." So again, this resistance of the pastors comes up, which is an interesting theme. In 1900, during the annual meeting of the United Church, the women started to meet in a very informal way during this Synod Church Convention. A woman named Mrs. Olive Fjellsted had a reception for women at her home in Minneapolis during the 1900 convention. Again, in 1901, they had a similar meeting at another woman's house. And finally, in 1903, the pastors' wives and other ladies who had met at these receptions came up with the idea of a mission box. And I think when I was a member of a circle a couple years ago, we were still having mission boxes. So this idea has held on long, but it originated in 1903 with the United Church Women. And their goal, their idea for this box, was that every pastor's wife would receive a box and her promise would be to put 5 cents a week into this box. She would also promise to get as many other women in her congregation as she could to take a box and to put their nickels each week into that box. And this is what happened. It's really amazing. They collected $800 during the first year, just with these mission box nickels. They collected $2,000 the second year and $4,000 the third year. From 1903 to 1917, I think that you'll excuse me, I'll nurse him while excuse me. Oh, Kai. It's rough, isn't it? Come on. Come on. Yeah. There you go. We forgot to bring a bottle along. And so, okay. Well, we'll see how this goes. You want to learn about the American Lutheran Church women, huh?
I'm worried about my stomach.
Right. So anyway, it's amazing to me the amount of money that these women were able to collect with these mission boxes. Thank you, Maury. And it's recorded in the records that from 1903 to 1917, they raised $65,000 with these mission boxes. That's 14 years. In 14 years, $65,000. The largest contributions in any one year were $10,000. So these women were really raising money. Finally, in 1906, they were still working on a formal organization. And in 1906, they sent out a questionnaire to every pastor in the United Church asking if he thought that it would be appropriate for the women to join together to form a women's mission organization. And Mrs. Engen writes about this. About what the responses to this questionnaire. She says, about a dozen gave encouraging answers. The majority did not answer, and a few asked if the women now were anxious to see their names in print. She says it was not very encouraging, which it sounds like it wasn't. But these women kept up their efforts, and in 1910, they requested permission from the United Church Board to formally organize. Mrs. Dahl, this woman who first had the dream, asked the United Church Board if they wouldn't form a committee of 3 men and 2 women to draft a constitution and bylaws to form a formal women's missionary federation. That was done, and in 1911 it was officially approved by the United Church Convention. And Mrs. Engen writes this, by this vote, the United Church Convention thereby gave their official recognition of the value of women's work in the church. So she was very pleased to see that happen. That afternoon, it was June 20th, 1911, the women met at the United Church Seminary, which is now the site of Luther Northwestern Seminaries, where I just graduated from. These women approved the Constitution and elected officers. Mrs. Dahl, who had had the original dream, was elected the first president of the United Church Women's Missionary Federation. And I've hung up around this fireplace just a few pictures. And there's a marvelous 2-page picture up here of the women who met on June 20th, 1911 to form this first Women's Missionary Federation of the United Church. So I encourage you to take a look at that picture. Right next to it is a picture of the first women officers, and Mrs. Dahl is on that picture, as is Mrs. Engen, who wrote the report. So that will personalize this history a little bit for you. They articulated 3 goals for the Federation. The first was loyalty to the Lord's commission to go and make disciples of all nations. The second was to unite women's societies within the United Church so that they could become stronger, and being working together, they could do further and greater mission work. And then the third goal was to educate about missions, especially about United Church missions. In 1912, this Mrs. Dahl appears again. She's dreaming again. She walked into this group of women who were busy stuffing envelopes to mail out tracts. That's one of the things that they did in their work with the WMF. She walked into the room, and I guess the story goes, she said, "Ladies, I'd like to talk with you." She said that she had gotten the idea that there was a need for mission homes. When missionaries came home on furlough from having worked in the field, there was no place for them to stay. And so she said, "I think that it should be the work of the Women's Missionary Federation to raise money to and build and furnish some homes for missionaries when they come home on furlough." And it's funny the way Mrs. Engen talks about this in her report. She says the ladies at this meeting were just flabbergasted. This seemed like an impossible dream to them. They had raised enough money to do some of this work, but to build homes seemed such an enormous task to them. And so Mrs. Dahl led these women in prayer. And this is what Mrs. Engen says about her prayer. "She did not have the slightest doubt as to God's willingness to give what was needed for the realization of this plan. She wrestled in her prayer with God like Jacob of old." And at the end of the prayer, the ladies in the room had agreed to join together in this effort. This was in 1912. By 1914, 2 years later, 4 mission cottages had been built and furnished and were being used by missionaries that year. These are still standing behind Luther Northwestern Seminaries in St. Paul. And I have the figures from the records. They raised 19... What? Oh, okay. Thank you. Team effort here. In those 2 years, they raised $19,000 to pay for the cottages. Yeah, I think he does need work. Thank you. Oh, they raised $19,000. He's not so happy, is he? They raised $19,000 for the cottages. $1,334 for grading, cement walks, and shrubbery, and $450 for an extra lot to make the backyards bigger, which is a total of $20,784 in 2 years they did this. Just enormous to me. During this time, they also raised $3,500 for a hydrotherapeutic department at Deaconess Hospital in Chicago, and $2,300 to start a girls' school in China. They also, at this time, recruited 2 women to go as women missionary doctors to China, because there was a great need for women doctors on mission fields. Women in China wouldn't go to male doctors. And so Miss Anna Huseth and Miss Frieda Nielsen volunteered to go to medical school after they had graduated from college. And so the WMF also began to raise money to pay these women's way through medical school and to support them when they could go as doctors to China. With all this money coming in and going out to the missions, this was still a very low-budget operation. There's an interesting story. Mrs. Dahl, says Mrs. Engen, had only 3 trips paid for during her whole time as president. She was often going out to talk to church bodies to try to raise money to educate about missions. And in that whole time, they paid for only 3 trips. There was one time when she was going to Clark Field, Minnesota, and there was no money left in the WMF budget or in her family budget. So she went to the mission board of the United Church and asked them to pay her expenses to Clark Field, Minnesota. She said that she was going there because she expected to go and receive she was hoping to receive a check for missions for $1,000. The Reverend Satterley was one of the members of the mission board, and he turned to Mrs. Dahl and said to her, "If you come back..." Yeah, Kai. Let's get us settled here, and then I'll tell the punchline. He said to her, "If you go to Clarkfield, Minnesota, and come back with a $1,000 check, we'll pay your way to Clarkfield, Minnesota." And Mrs. Dahl came back with a $1,000 check. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, she did. So that's the kind of shoestring budget that these women were working out of. They used almost nothing of the money that they raised for administrative costs. It all went into this mission work, building cottages, building schools. And it's in the records, the columns of figures aren't there, but there's a quotation by Lars Lund, who was the treasurer of the United Church. And he is reported to have told Mrs. Engen that in the years of the United Church, the women's organizations raised over $500,000 in 27 years. So they were just incredible givers for the work of spreading the word, spreading the gospel. Raised incredible amounts of money, I think, even by today's standards, for that kind of work.
I was baptized in that church.
Were you really?
Huh.
Must have been a good church to give Mrs. Dahl her money, too. I'd like to go on to talk now about the third group, the third story, the mission dove of the Haugie Synod. And this has particularly personal meaning for me because my husband's grandmother, Mrs. Mary Nelson Wee, is one of the charter members of the Mission Dove group, the women's organization in the Haugie Church. And she died before I ever met Maury's family. And so I don't know much about her except through stories. And researching this project and finding out how involved she was and what a key figure she was in this organization has really meant a lot to me in this research. My information for this section about the Mission Dove comes from articles by Maury's grandmother, Mrs. Wee, and by a woman named Mrs. C.J. Eastvold, which is another name that some of you might recognize in the Haugie Synod. She was a big, important figure, it seems. And I have pictures up there of Mrs. Wee. I don't think I have one of Mrs. Eastvold up there. The background for the women's organization in this church is in the late 19th century. And Mrs. Eastvold writes that women had begun even then to work for missions in what she says is a quiet, small way, by making and selling articles to raise money to send to the mission fields. There was nothing in a broad, organized way, but in their local congregations, some women were getting together to do these things in a quiet, small way. The money that they raised, they sent to Norway, to the Norwegian Mission Board, because the Haugie Synod didn't have any organized mission board of its own. And so the Norwegian church then sent the money to Madagascar, to Zululand, and to India. Those are the three places the mission money went. Mrs. Eastvold says that it was difficult to begin these women's groups, even in a local level, because, she said, husbands objected. They supposed, she said, that the meetings would be only for gossip. That's what she says in her report. And so the women who were more timid, she said, stayed away. They were afraid to come. But there were some zealous women who kept encouraging them. And she writes that also that some of the Haugie ministers were very supportive of this beginning women's work for missions. So that's where their support came from. In 1891, the Haugie Synod called three of their own missionaries to go to China. And that's when this story really begins in the Haugie Synod. The Reverend N.N. Running, you'll probably recognize that name, Miss Olive Hudnefield, and Hannah Roram. And the Roram name is an old name in the American Lutheran Church. She eventually married the Reverend N.N. Running. And so she became Hannah Roram Running. They all agreed to go to China. And this was a very exciting time in the Haugie Church for missions, and this was what first began to ignite the women of the Haugie Church, began to ignite their interest in mission work. They have also at this time began to support home missions by raising money for Red Wing Seminary, which was the Haugie Synod Seminary to train pastors. One of their big projects was to equip the hospital there. Finally, Maury's grandmother, Mrs. Wee, was the one responsible for getting the idea to organize these local women's mission groups into a broad organization in the Haugie Synod. She had seen the Swedish Lutheran Church women in this country do a similar thing. That's where she got the idea first. And so she went to the June 12, 1901 Haugie Synod Convention in Jewell, Iowa. And she writes in her in the archive stuff that she went especially to see if she couldn't get a women's missionary organization started. She writes, "I thought that we needed the same privilege of getting together and exchanging ideas and opinions as our men did." And I'm going to read you a few things that she writes, which are very interesting. So Mrs. Wee went and talked to Mrs. Hannah Roram running by this time, who was home on furlough. Okay, I'm sorry. You're doing great. So these two women got together at this synodical convention and suggested the idea of a women's missionary society. Mrs. Wee writes about the response. The men, with few exceptions, were averse to women's activities outside the home and did not like these doings. Reverend Gerstead shut the door in my face and forbid me to see his wife if I was to invite her to any secret meetings. Professor Hegstrom led his wife away, saying that she had plenty of stockings to darn at home without wasting time on women's meetings. Other men begged me not to start anything new. Many things could be told in this connection, but it would be too lengthy. So there was some resistance on the part of people to this idea of women getting together to form a broad organization. But the women persisted. Their dream was to have an organization for all women. It seems that the men didn't think that was such a good idea. And so Mrs. Wee writes, to satisfy our men, is how she puts it, they made a compromise and formed a federation of pastors' wives, professors and professors' wives, and all women missionaries. So that was the group that they started in the Haugi Synod. She said that both she and Mrs. Eastfold talk about what a new idea this was in the Haugi Synod. The people didn't know how to respond to it. So many women refused to join. They were afraid of the idea. And there were a lot of jokes made about the group. She said especially about the name, the Mission Dove. They talked about how these women would, if they couldn't get an organization started in one church, they'd fly over to the next church to get another organization started there. So they made a lot of fun of the name, it seems. But it was finally started on June 12, 1901, with the support of the Haugi Synod Convention. Mrs. Hannah Running, this missionary to China, opened with devotions. And I'm so thankful that Mrs. Wee recorded these devotions because they're very interesting. Mrs. Running said in these opening devotions that their first duty, she admonished us that as mothers we must always remember that our first duty was to our husband and children. That was their important work. But, Mrs. Running said, we must not be content to let it end there. As surely as God would call us to answer for our nearest and dearest, so surely would he hold us responsible for the lost souls about us and for our unhappy sisters across the sea. She reminded us that every good work is criticized and that if our association should be successful, we must be prepared to bear criticism. The truth of this we realized very soon. But Mrs. Running was there with her opening devotions to inspire these women to begin work in this organization, even if they were doing it in the face of some criticism. It's interesting, I think he's ready for another bird. It's interesting to note the projects of the Mission Dove during the years 1901 to 1917. They established a school for educating Bible women in China, and for 10 years the women of the Haugi Synod were the sole supporters of this school. So they sent a lot of money to that school, which usually had between 30 and 40 students in it each year. They also got the idea of building a rest home for missionaries home on furlough. It was first suggested, I think I should take him again. Maybe if you walk him, he'll get better. It was first suggested in 1911, but not realized until 1914. And Mrs. Wee writes that there was resistance to this idea, too, to build a home for missionaries for furlough. She writes, it seemed as if our people had to be educated up to any new idea. So there was resistance for that, too. But this house is still standing on Keston Street in St. Anthony Park, and it's interesting to hear the story about how these women built the house. They were very practical in the way they built it. They built a two-story house with a kitchen on each floor so that two missionary families, if they were small, could live in it, or you could have a single missionary living upstairs and a family downstairs. So that struck me as just such so practical. And then they told the builders to use the best of everything in constructing this house, for it may be a long while before we can build another such home, Mrs. Eastfold writes. And so they made built a very well-constructed home and raised $6,000 to pay for the home in the 3 years, 1914 to 1917, before the merger.
They also at this time sent Mrs. Eastfold to China as a representative for the 25th year Jubilee. They were celebrating their 25 years of mission work in China, of the Lutheran Church, the Broad Lutheran Churches. And they were very proud that they were the only organization in the Lutheran Churches to send a woman. Mrs. Eastfold was the only woman at the 25th year Jubilee. And several women in the archive letters commented about that they were so proud that they had sent Mrs. Eastfold. And finally, the fourth thing that they did that was different from other women's organizations too, they started a church column in the church letter to go out in the weekly church letters so that women could read through the written word and stay organized and linked up with each other through the written word, through this newsletter called the Bude Barinen. Is that what the place letter was? I don't know what that means, but it was Mrs. Wee who edited that. Okay, newsletter? Newsletter, all right. And that was edited by Mrs. Wee, Maury's grandmother. So it's been interesting to me to read that. And it seems that as the women's work went on, the men's attitude towards it changed. And Mrs. Wee writes at the end of her report, "As time went on, our men entirely overcame their prejudice to women's work and heartily endorsed whatever we did. They even gave over their Sunday meetings to us, and at these we received large offerings to our work. Those of us who had braved the first hardship have often spoken of these changes." And so by the end of the time of the Halsey Synod, the men had become very supportive, and the women had also of this good women's mission work that was being done in the Halsey Synod. I'd like to move on now with these three stories in the background to talk about what I see as some of the interesting and important issues that emerged from this whole thing. And the first thing I think that's important to remember, or important to understand, is the social context in which these women and men were living during the time of these organizations. The first important social factor, I think, is Victorianism. And this was the height of Victorianism in America in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The Victorian understanding of the roles for men and women were that they were to be separate, in separate spheres. Tennyson has a poem called The Princess in which he talks about this. Man is the head, woman is the heart. Man is to be in the world, woman to be in the home. And these were really... And these were recognized and upheld in our country as well as in England. Men were to be working at the public affairs. Women were to be working at the private affairs. Men were to be involved in organizations, women in the home. Men were to deal with politics, affairs of the world. Women were to deal with family relationships. Men were to meet together to work on common goals. Women were more to stay in their homes doing work for the family. So there was that understanding of roles of men and women at work in the lives of these women of these organizations. But as a counterpoint to that, these women were also pioneers in settling a very unsettled area of America. Pioneer America demanded hard work from both men and women. It was very difficult many times to maintain these separate spheres, man out in the world, woman at home. When it was harvest time, everybody was in the field working. And so it was difficult in the pioneer work to maintain those separate spheres that Victorian world seemed to thought was so important. Yeah, they merged out real fast for these pioneer people. And I think that in pioneer America there was also a recognition of the great contribution that women made, even if they were in a separate sphere. If women got sick and couldn't cook on the farm couldn't continue. If women couldn't wash their men's clothes or do the gardening, raise chickens, milk the cows, do all that stuff, the farm collapsed. And so there was great recognition not only of the worth of men's work in the field, but of women's work at the home, I think. That's right. So, yeah, if you didn't do it. So the pouring of our ideal was very difficult to uphold. And I think that these two influences are interesting to look at as in the backdrop of the formation of these organizations. You can see in these accounts where the men and women are caught between this ideal of Victorian separate spheres and what they were experiencing in their real life settling the land of the Midwest. I think that these two influences account for some of the opposition that the women experienced in trying to form their own organization. These women had, and some men had, a vision of a women's organization, but the social ideals of the time, Victorianism, said that women couldn't meet together for public work. Women were supposed to stay in their homes. And I think that it's maybe the influence of some of that that accounted for why some of these husbands and pastors were initially so against women working together for missions. And so it's these women, these foremothers of the ALPW, were really challenging some strong social roles in this country when they were beginning to get together in their small, quiet, and eventually large ways to work together to raise money for missions. That's one interesting thing that I've noticed. I think these two influences also account for why women established a separate organization instead of trying to join with the men. Women couldn't vote in these church bodies. When the Houses Synod met, the United Church met, when the Norwegian Synod met for their synodical convention, men had the vote. Men could speak at the meetings. It was the men determining the way the church was to go. And seeing this, I guess if women wanted to organize, I guess there are at least two ways they could have gone. They could have said, we'd like to be part of this, the regular men's synod church, or we'd like to form our own. And I think that with this separate sphere idea, maybe it seemed more logical to them to form their separate organization, because in none of the records that I've been able to find has it been suggested that the women join the try to work to get the vote in the men's church. It was more, we'll form our own separate organization, have our own officers and constitution, and vote on our own policies. I think so, at that time. But that was an easier idea to introduce and to get people to support. Yeah. I think that's true. So they chose to form their own where they could be in control. And because I've often wondered, why do we have this auxiliary set up? And this is interesting history to me to help explain why they formed a separate organization. I think also influencing them to go that way were that women in other church bodies went that way. Methodist women, Presbyterian women, Swedish Lutheran women. A lot of women in this country had formed their own separate auxiliaries in the church organization. And so I think seeing those other women doing it made the women of our synod think maybe that could work for us too. So I think that the social situation of the day encouraged this formation of a separate women's organization. And it's interesting to me to note how often it's said that when these women's organizations were finally formally recognized by the church body, that they saw this as recognition of women's work in the church. But it seems, as I read the records, that there was a feeling that before there was formal organization, that women's work sometimes went unnoticed. It wasn't seen as very important in the church. But when the women got organized and formed their own group, then the church recognized the work and valued it and would come to the women and say, what can you do to help us with this mission project? Or we'd like you to raise money to equip our hospital. Could you do that? And so since they organizing themselves formally helped the church body as a whole recognize and value the worth of women's work. It also became easier to coordinate women's work and they could do much bigger and greater things. Just having more funds, more people involved, they could do more work, like forming a girls' school in China, missing homes in this country, sending women doctors to medical school. I think that there's another interesting thing. You can see what you think of this, but I think that having the stream of Victorian ideals in this country and the reality of pioneer work and pioneer life made these women see the connections between these two worlds too. And I think that's clear in what in Mrs. Hannah Running's opening devotion, where she says that our Lord will not only call us to account for the nearest and dearest to us, but he'll also call us to account for the salvation of our sisters abroad. Remember she said that in her opening devotion? I think that these women, as I read what they've written, they saw a connection between bringing their families to Christ and bringing the global family to Christ, between bringing their children, their sisters and brothers and husbands to Christ and sharing the gospel with them, helping them, making clothes for them, feeding them, clothing them. They made a connection between that kind of work and doing that in a global way for people in China and Africa and other places. That's an interesting connection to me that they made between their home life and the world, which I think these two separate spheres helped feed that. Then I think that I read also in the records an especial concern for women in other cultures. For instance, it's interesting to read when the first accounts of foot binding of women in China came back to the women in this country. We hadn't known about that before our people started going over to China. And when missionaries to China came back with the and told stories about how women's feet were bound in China so they couldn't walk, about how women couldn't be educated in China, about the lack of good health care for women in China, it's interesting to read the responses of women in this country to that, and they became very concerned for their sisters in China, particularly their sisters. And those accounts got a lot of enthusiasm going for women's mission projects and accounted for raising a lot of money and for women doctors to go over there, women teachers to go over there to teach in school. And there was this connection, women in this country with women in other countries, that is interesting to me. There's an interesting phrase that appears in some of these records, women for women, which is an interesting phrase to me. And that's one of the great motivators, it seems to me, of women's mission work in this country, their concern for women abroad. So these are what I see are some of the reasons that account for first the creation of separate women's organizations in the church and of the passion for women in this country for mission work. It's the enthusiasm and the drive and the passion that they had for mission work was just tremendous. Lois?
Is there something in that about the role of the
That was separate from the women's group, but very supported by the women's group. For instance, the United Church Women raised money to provide a new facility at the Deaconess Hospital in Chicago. I think that link does maybe. I'd like to close, it's time for lunch, but I would just like to close with what I think is a very powerful closing sentence of Mrs. Eastfold's report on women's work. She says, "May we who yet remain in the militant church continue faithful in the mission God has entrusted us to accomplish." And I think that's a strong message to us today, too, still living in the militant church. Yes?
I want to bring something to the group. You're all from the district. This Joint Synod of Ohio goes clear back here also. They started the mission field in India. Today we had July the 19th was the 91st birthday of a lady who served with her family in India. And she is still living, a member of our congregation. And this, the Iowa Synod, established the mission field in New Guinea. And that has been the fastest growing mission field in the world.
Yeah.
And never forget it. So this, the New Guinea mission field comes from here, and the Indian mission field comes from here. Well, this was started in the 20s, and you know what happened in the 20s. We had a financial collapse. The Joint Synod of Ohio had money, lots of money, because they had, that year, had accumulated money. Well, the Joint Synod of Ohio was having to pull out of New Guinea. So this is how that merger came at that time in the 1930s, because they would have to give up their mission field in New Guinea if the Ohio Synod did not join them. So they did. And we went through this period. I went through this period as a young person. I also went through the period of 1960 of working with our Norwegian sisters in setting up the ALDW at that time. I remember going home to my own congregation. They were griping at me, and I said, "We'll have to walk one more mile with our Norwegian sisters."